The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, roughly paraphrased by Zizek, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. Today, I want to take up a very venerable monster who's getting on in age and who recently announced his retirement from being a newspaper columnist. I'm talking about Pat Buchanan. And I was struck not just by the news, which is not unexpected. He is, well past being a senior citizen, but the lack of reaction that I didn't see a lot about this. And friend of the podcast, John Gans, on his Substack, Unpopular Fronts, did a very nice survey of Buchanan and his importance. And one of the points he made was that Buchanan is the dominant figure on the American right, and more important than people that are perhaps more widely discussed, like William F. Buckley Jr. And I think John is right. And so I want to talk about the importance of Buchanan and his place in history. And I think he's crucial for understanding where the American right is right now. If there's an addiction to culture war, the politics of race and gender are so dominant, I think Buchanan is a big part of the reason. Now, to discuss this, I'm very happy to have on the historian Nicole Hemmer, who is the founding director of the Carolyn T. and Robert M. Rogers Center for the Study of the Presidency at Vanderbilt University, a widely published scholar, both in academia and in more popular outlets like the Washington Post and the New York Times. And for our purposes, recently published author of a book called Partisans, which is about the conservative revolutionaries who remade American politics in the 1990s. And we're a podcast, so you can't see this, but if you Google her book, it has a very striking cover, which has Pat Buchanan right on the front of the cover. It's actually a lovely cover. I whoever did the design deserves all props. So I'm very happy to have Nicole here. And maybe just we'll go to the history of Buchanan and who he is, but maybe we can just start with a brief sense of why I feel he's important and why Nicole also feels he's important enough to put on the cover of her book.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me, Jeet. And I do actually agree with John Gans that Buchanan is probably a more significant, if underappreciated, figure than somebody like William F. Buckley Jr. If William F. Buckley Jr. was sort of the brains of Cold War conservatism, Buchanan is both the brains and the emotional heart of the post-Cold War conservative movement, and so was not able only to bridge the Cold War and post-Cold War right, but was really able to tap into both the emotion and the intellectual movement behind what would emerge and what ultimately would give us figures like Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, which might also explain why he's perhaps faded from view, because his political project is done. He won the war, and now he seems less relevant because he's less necessary in a way.
Yeah, no, that's right. And before we get into his sort of history, I just want to, one thing that you brought up, which I think is very important, is the sort of both the brains and the heart, which is that he, Buchanan, if you look at his career, was part of many different things and was able to bring a lot of different things together. That's to say, he was both, a newspaper columnist, but, wrote for intellectual magazines like National Review and hung out with very important intellectuals like Joseph Soberne and Sam T. Francis, who weren't very widely known by the public, but are key theorists. But he also, worked as an operative in the Nixon, Ford, and Reagan mm-hmm. administrations, and was a kind of liaison between them and the sort of hard right. And he was also a television personality, and he ran for president on a number of occasions. And so it was like a public figure in that way. So it's really a remarkable number of things that he brought together, which I find it, usually it's like people do one or two of these things and not like all of them. So I think that's also very interesting about him. But maybe to like just, I think to understand Buchanan, when you talk about the heart, it's a he talk in his autobiography, he talks about a conservatism of the heart, and conservatism based on like loyalty to family and to values. And he's very much speaks of the autobiographical origins of his view of the world, growing up in this German Irish Catholic family in the early 20th century. And strikingly in his autobiography, right from the start, he mentions, like in his household there were like three heroes: the Spanish fascist dictator Francisco Franco, the military general Douglas MacArthur, and the Cold War demagogue Joseph McCarthy. So, what does that constellation tell us? What is this world that Buchanan is coming out of?
Well, it shows us that he comes from a strict, more authoritarian worldview, somebody who really appreciates authoritarianism and appreciates strong-arm tactics and appreciates force. I mean, this is something that if you also read his autobiography, you'll know he's constantly like recounting fights that he gets in. He talks about boxing in order to make him strong as a young child, and that respect for force was something that was really important to Buchanan, and a kind of suspicion of democracy, which is going to come back in the 1990s. But it was there, as his autobiography suggests, right from the beginning, that it was something that was tied into his life, and that he was looking for sources of inspiration both among conservative Irish Americans, but also abroad. That there was something inspiring about somebody like Franco who blended his religion and his politics, and Catholicism would be a pretty important part of Pat Buchanan's worldview and his identity. And you can tell that from the house he grew up in.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think that it's good that you mentioned the Catholicism, because it's a particular brand of Catholicism. Growing up, before Vatican II, there was a kind of strong, there was a tensions within American Catholicism at that time between the sort of more liberal Americanizing wing and people who had a more explicitly authoritarian view and who were suspicious of democracy as something that's like hostile to Catholic values. And so I think that debate within Catholicism is very important, and he is very much a pre-Vatican II Catholic in that sense. So this constellation, and I mean, to actually underscore the Catholicism, I mean, another figure that he mentions in his autobiography is Father Coughlin, who was a an anti-Semitic radio demagogue. And I don't want to I don't think we should ignore the anti-Semitism, especially, I mean, John Gans in his review pointed out something that's in the biography by Tim Stanley of Buchanan, which is that his the Buchanan household basically terrorized their Jewish neighbors, and hurled all sorts of epithets, and used physical violence to intimidate their the Jewish people that were unfortunate enough to live next to them.
Yes, and that anti-Semitism is going to be a feature of Buchanan's politics basically for his whole life. It comes up more in the 1980s and 1990s as he's becoming a political figure in his own right. But his defense of Nazis, his downplaying of the Holocaust, there is this real vein of anti-Semitism that runs through his politics and the things that he chooses to focus on, his celebration of German military might in World War II, books about why we shouldn't have gone to war in World War II, why that was a bad war to go into. And it is something that causes a kind of break between Buchanan and other parts of the conservative movement. I mean, Bill Buckley writes a kind of lengthy piece looking at Buchanan's anti-Semitism in the early 1990s. So there is a kind of the anti-Semitism is pretty clear when it comes to Buchanan, which is why it's so remarkable that he has such a long public career, with very little blowback for that anti-Semitism.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is interesting to think about, like, you know, like why, you know, someone who in his autobiography talks about enjoying Father Coughlin, there wasn't that suspicion. But I mean, I think one perhaps reason he was able to become a more mainstream figure is the Cold War, which had a sort of complex series of effects of both mainstreaming sort of, you know, right-wing Catholicism, that in the 1950s, you know, Catholics were seen as more respectable and therefore, you know, like able to get jobs in the FBI and were like more visibly public as part of the sort of pantheon of American religion. You know, this is the era of, you know, a Catholic, Protestant, and Jew is seen as all American and leading to the, you know, Kennedy becoming president. But also, so there's a kind of assimilation of Catholicism into the American mainstream, which maybe takes some of these, you know, Coughlinite rough edges out. But also the Cold War in some ways made the older imperatives, the old right authoritarianism, it muted that somehow because there was more of a need of a coalition between sort of, you know, the old right and Cold War liberals, you know, especially like it after the Vietnam War. But I mean, you certainly see this change that the Cold War is bringing about. Historians of conservatism often talk about it in terms of fusionism. And this is a kind of a term of art, but I think it's very useful to understand that there was a kind of a new conservatism that emerged in the 50s, which was fusionist and which muted some of the old right tendencies of, you know, isolationism and overt anti-Semitism. Can you maybe explain what this fusionism was?
Sure. So the Cold War does have this kind of constraining effect in some ways, because the U.S. has to be held up as this avatar of democracy and of diversity in some ways, some limited ways, and unity. And that has an effect on the conservative movement, a conservative movement that had been somewhat atomized, that had been very committed to anti-interventionism, had these strains of pro-fascism, or at least fascism friendliness, and anti-Semitism. And in order to kind of fit into the politics of the Cold War era, some of those things had to go away. And in suppressing both the anti-interventionism and suppressing the anti-Semitism, you were able to, as I think it's Frank Meyer defines it, to fuse together different strands of conservatism that had not always been on the same page or been part of the same movement. And the strands that he sees as being fused together are libertarianism, this idea of small government, of radical individualism, the strain of traditionalism, a commitment, as we were talking about, with those sort of unreformed Catholics, and a devotion to traditional hierarchies and social structures, including things like segregation. And then those are fused together by a commitment to anti-communism, something that both traditionalists and libertarians could agree upon. And so anti-communism becomes the, and this kind of militaristic anti-communism becomes the glue that holds this movement together, but it requires some concessions. Concessions like being more involved in the world in order to combat this existential threat coming from the Soviet Union. So that's what Meyer sees, and then Buckley promotes as the new conservatism of the Cold War.
That's right. So anti-communism is the glue that brings together people that are otherwise very disparate. I mean, like, you know, from libertarians who want less government to someone who's like an authoritarian like Buchanan, there is a big kind of difference. And I should mention for listeners, the real, you know, historian who did laid out this framework is George Nash, you know, very important, I think flawed in some ways, but a book I can argue with, but a very important book on the, you know, conservative intellectual movement. And he puts fusionism as the great achievement. And one thing that's interesting in Nash's book is he mentions that anti-communism is a glue, and there's points where he speculates, like, what happens if anti-communism is not there? And then we'll get to that. But the other thing with the fusionist consensus that was created is that there were always people in the consensus who felt that they were getting the shaft. One is a sort of, on the one hand, you had the more extreme libertarians like Murray Rothbard, who thought that they were had to buy into, you know, the military industrial complex. And on the other hand, you had traditionalists like William F. Buckley's brother-in-law, L. Brent Bozell Jr., who basically thought that the fusionist was just a way of letting big business and anti-communist dominate, and the traditionalists would just get rhetorical praise, but that their issues like abortion were not going to be paid attention to. So there's this kind of, within that fusionist consensus, there's a kind of, you know, various factions are always like thinking like they're being subsumed and they're being forced to make compromises that they didn't want to make. But I think it's true to say, like, if one wants to understand, the sort of conservative movement, like in the period of the 60s and 70s and 80s, is it fair to say fusionism was the dominant mode?
It absolutely was. And you're right that there was this greater diversity that was happening within the conservative movement. And perhaps that sense that you're getting the shaft is actually the glue that held the conservative movement together, because it was a pretty common emotion at the heart of the conservative movement. But the idea that fusionism was conservatism, I think, was made very clear by Ronald Reagan, who was able to bring in the religious right to his coalition while at the same time embracing supply side economics, slashing taxes, rolling back on regulation. And so in many ways, Reaganism was fusionism in office, right? He is able to govern in a way that both paid fealty to the various strains of the conservative movement, but also exacerbated some of those tensions that you were talking about before. The new right and the religious right regularly felt like they were getting the short end of the stick from the Reagan administration, that he was all in when it came to his kind of conservative libertarianism. He was all in when it came to the Cold War. But when it came to things like promoting a constitutional amendment for abortion or a constitutional amendment restoring school prayer, that he was paying lip service to it, but not actually following through. And that generates a considerable amount of criticism from his right. And you can begin to see now that conservatives have power, that those fracture lines are going to become more important because there is something more at stake.
Yeah, in some ways, it's easier for the conservative movement when it was in opposition to hold together because they're fighting this sort of, you know, liberal dominance. But once they're in power, then people start asking, what am I getting from this? And I think it's a fascinating part of your book, Partisans, that talk about the dissatisfaction with Reagan that was on the right. And I think many of our listeners, especially on The Nation, might think, like, how could conservatives be unhappy with Reagan? You mentioned some of the stuff. There's also in your book, you talk about judges, right? Like, there was a feeling that the judges that Reagan was putting in are, you know, business friendly, but not necessarily friendly on issues like abortion. Do you want to like say anything? I mean, Buchanan's sort of interesting in this situation because he went to work for the Reagan administration, but he's also a critic of Reagan from the right.
That's right. So this group called the New Right had been levying complaints about Reagan even before Reagan ran in 1980. They didn't see him as conservative enough for some of the very reasons that we've talked about, and because he was getting older. And they were like, we need somebody young and we need somebody who is really going to push for all of these things. Sandra Day O'Connor becomes the nominee for the Supreme Court. They're really mad about that. They don't think that she's conservative enough. They also argue that he only put her on the court because she was a woman, and that is playing with identity politics. They are absolutely livid when he agrees to raise taxes. They're absolutely livid when he begins opening negotiations with the Soviet Union. It's at that point that one of the New Right leaders calls him a useful idiot for Soviet communism, which is quite a thing to say about Ronald Reagan. And Pat Buchanan is part of that mix. He's part of that mix of people who are taking swings at Reagan. And that, in fact, is how he becomes part of the Reagan administration. Leaders of the New Right give the Reagan administration a list of people who they think Reagan should add to his administration as a kind of sop to the new right and to these critics. And Pat Buchanan is the one that they ultimately hire. He comes in as Reagan's communications director. And what's fascinating about him is he comes in as Reagan's communications director, and he takes those same fights. First of all, to the administration, he will continue to cause chaos within the administration. And when he loses those fights as communications director, he'll just go off and he'll like write an op-ed in the Washington Post criticizing the administration, even as a member of it. And so he plays along somewhat, but he doesn't allow himself to be fully muzzled as a member of the administration for the 2 short years that he's there.
Yeah, now that you mentioned this, it's kind of striking that the difference between him under Reagan and him under Nixon, because he'd also worked under the Nixon administration and was kind of in the same sort of function. He was the liaison agent between, you know, Nixon, who was seen as a more establishment right Republican, and the hard right that distrusted Nixon. My sense is, like, from both your book and from others' writings on Buchanan, he's like much more loyal to Nixon. I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head, but it is an interesting difference.
Oh, it's very different, in part because, you know, Nixon plucks Buchanan out of relative obscurity. He was an opinion writer and an editor for a St. Louis newspaper. And he's still in his 20s when Nixon taps him to come be an aide and a speechwriter for the Nixon campaign and then into the administration. And there is that kind of loyalty. I think Buchanan's nickname for him is the old man. And he, even through Watergate and even well after, continues to put Nixon at the heart of the stories that he tells. He's written a couple of very laudatory books about Richard Nixon because he does feel that loyalty. And he writes in his book, one of his many books, that he felt sick when Nixon opened China, one of these big fault lines between the conservative movement and the Nixon administration. But he is definitely not out there writing criticisms of Nixon, because in that case, because Nixon is a kind of father figure, the loyalty trumps the ideology. With Reagan, Buchanan doesn't feel any sort of loyalty. And in fact, you know, even while he's in the Reagan administration, he is plotting his moves to run for president himself because he thinks Reagan has fallen so short.
Yeah, I think that's right, that there is a kind of a father figure element to Nixon, and, you know, just reading Buchanan's autobiography, you know, like, the father is always a big figure. You know, the father is the guy who taught them to fight, and you want to be a manly man like the father. And I'm also thinking that even, like, although Nixon's had many more sort of violations of conservative norms than Reagan did, you arguably, I mean, like, you know, like the opening to China, but also, you know, wage and price control. This is a lot of the domestic policies. But maybe, like, Nixon's pugnaciousness, and that he's a kind of like a fighter, and that, you know, like, overrides everything, that there's a kind of like emotional attachment. And it, precisely because in Watergate, he's like kind of besieged by the media and the Democrats in Congress, you know. So Nixon is, you know, the policies are maybe less significant than the fact that this is a guy who's, you know, really hates liberals in the way that Buchanan does, and is like willing to, like, take the fight to them.
I think that's right, that there's an affective connection between the two of them. And I think you're also hitting it on the head with that kind of anti-liberalism, because that becomes so much the emotional core of the right moving into the 1990s. And Buchanan understands that instinctively, in part probably because he learns it from Nixon. It is not, I mean, certainly Reagan takes his swings at liberals, but he doesn't have that same kind of in his bones, I hate these guys kind of feel to him.
Well, no, I mean, no, Reagan is a very different figure, just because, you know, he's not a born and bred Republican. You know, he had been a Democrat for a long time. And there is that, you know, famous geniality, and maybe coupled with the sort of, you know, Cold War concern for, like, sort of consensus building, or, you know, like the sense that, you know, America has to be unified. And so Reagan does have these outreach moments to Tip O'Neill. So there is a way in which I mean, Reagan, the what you call the affective concern, like there's something about Reagan's personality that might have made him very popular with the general public, but what's really set the right off.
Absolutely. And this is something that becomes a big break between the right of the 1980s and the right of the 1990s, is that Reagan, in many ways, his project is to build a consensus around conservatism. And in some ways, he does that. I mean, he wins these massive landslide elections, as does George H.W. Bush, his first go around. And the figures of the 1990s are really trying to use conservatism to divide, believing that that can be a road to power as well. And it's a very different approach, and it hits on very different emotional vectors. I mean, it's the difference between Morning in America and Pat Buchanan's convention speech in 1992. They're just very different visions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, I mean, that issue of division versus unity, national unity, is very key. And I think that there's a famous memo that Buchanan wrote in the Nixon administration, where he says, you know, we'll tear the country in half and we'll have the bigger half. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the phrase that was used was positive polarization. That, yes, you know, like if we, you know, hit if you have Spiro Agnew's kind of speeches attacking, you know, liberals as these nattering nahabs of negativism, which is Buchanan's, as was actually the writer of that, and then, you know, like really polarizing and attacking, you know, the press as the enemy, the liberal elite as the enemy, this will be very divisive for America, but, you know, like the political upside.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Because that we'll be the majority in that situation.
Absolutely. And what I like about the phrase positive polarization and that iteration of the idea is that it is a reminder that polarization is a tactic rather than a description of politics, right? It is something that political figures use in order to achieve something politically, rather than just kind of like the state of things as they unfolded.
Yeah, no, that's right. So so he has this sort of polarizing Nixonian instinct, but he's in the, you know, Reagan White House, and Reagan, you know, tries to be a more genial figure, and is also, you know, like tries to, Reagan, the other big difference is that he's offering a positive vision of America in terms of like immigration, right? You know, going along with amnesty, and you know, Reagan's, if you look back on both the speeches he and his vice president, George H.W. Bush, did, you know, their statements on immigration are very different than, you know, what we'll later see from people like Buchanan and Trump. So within that mix, that Reagan White House, it's a very curious situation of to be the sort of liaison to the hard right, unhappy with Reagan, but, you know, like trying to push him to be a more polarizing figure. And in some ways, the end of Reagan's presidency and the fact that he's no longer president but can become this mythic figure that, you know, we name airports after, creates a new opening for figures like Buchanan. They can, you know, like be much more vocal about their unhappiness with the Republican Party than they could under Reagan.
especially because they now have a new target. They can leave Reagan alone. Reagan's going to go off into retirement. He can become, as you were saying, this mythological figure. But now they have George H.W. Bush in the White House, and they never trusted him and they never liked him. So every time he commits the same kinds of heresies that Reagan committed, like raising taxes, Bush just gets it straight on the chin, right? They're swinging and they're connecting every single time because Bush is such an easy figure on the right to beat up on because he doesn't invoke that same kind of loyalty. And he doesn't have that same kind of support or standing on the right, but also just in the United States more generally. And so that's where Pat Buchanan and others on the right are able to sharpen their anti-Reagan politics is as a kind of anti-Bush politics. And this is where you see figures like Newt Gingrich starts to break ranks even more in this period when he quite famously helps to broker the budget deal that will raise taxes. And then right before the Rose Garden ceremony announcing it, veers off and goes to a press conference to denounce it. And this is also the period in which Pat Buchanan starts to come out more vocally against the politics of the Reagan era. He kind of played around with it. He floated the idea of a presidential run in 1988, but the Reagan legacy was so large at that time, it was very difficult for him to do. But by 1991, he's out there writing columns because he's back in the news game, where he is making very clear the distinctions between himself and President Bush and the politics of the 1980s. And that's also the place where he's working out his thoughts about new political figures on the horizon, like David Duke, and saying, look, I'm not going to say go vote for a Klansman, but Duke is onto something. And if we can expropriate these ideas and the emotions that they tap into and the fears that they tap into and bring that to the heart of our politics, we're going to be in better shape. And it's that idea of division and polarization and emotion that he's working out during the Bush years and will put into his 92 campaign.
That's right. So in this sort of, like post-Reagan era, the sort of fractures on the right start to become more visible. And as we mentioned before, partially this issue of the Cold War is no longer there to unify the right. And you start seeing these divisions, and Buchanan's not alone. There's a larger group of sort of intellectuals and sort of policy entrepreneurs that get labeled or call themselves the paleocons or paleoconservatives. Just to throw out some names out there, it would be the people associated with Chronicles magazine, Tom Fleming, Samuel T. Francis, and within National Review's Joseph Soborn has strong affinities, and he would soon break with sort of National Review. Do you want to outline where these sort of paleoconservatives are coming from and their kind of views?
Sure. So we had talked earlier about the constraining force of the Cold War as bringing together the Cold War conservative movement. In other ways, it also limited the political options for policy entrepreneurs and for political thinkers. For instance, during the Cold War, it was expected that you would sing peons to democracy because democracy was at the heart of the Cold War. And once the Cold War ends, you have figures like Francis and like Buchanan who are out there saying, yeah, democracy isn't that great. Now that we won the Cold War and we've defeated communism, now it's time, as Buchanan writes, to turn our attention to defeating democracy. And to addressing both the ills of democracy and the false image around it as this ideal form of government. And he's writing that just as soon as the Berlin Wall comes down, he is on this beat. And that suggests that the constraining power of the Cold War had been a real force in American politics, but that the old right that was more or less muted, if not demolished, by the Cold War, had been there all along. Those ideas had been in ferment. And when there was more space to explore those ideas, they come open. And the same thing is true for things like, you talked about how Reagan embraced the kinds of ideas of bringing people together, uniting people, you know, not being anti-Semitic, not being openly racist. These ideas that had become particularly important by the late 1960s and the 1970s in mainstream national politics, people like Sam Francis are coming out and saying, this idea that everyone's going to eventually be equal, that's not actually realistic, that in fact that there are clear differences between the races and there's a clear racial hierarchy, and we are doing ourselves a real disservice by not acknowledging that. And again, those ideas had been there. Richard Herrnstein was writing about IQ differences and writing about race and race realism back in the 1970s, but it takes the end of the Cold War and this kind of opening up of a political and intellectual space for those old right and what we might consider far right, they've become more mainstream ideas to move to the center of conservative debate.
Yeah, no, I think that's the major change. And I think, you know, if one were to use the language of psychology, it's sort of the return of the repressed. That, you know, like all the ideas from the, you know, 30s and 40s and 50s of, you know, MacArthur, McCarthy, Coughlin, Franco, you know, like we have to, you know, put them in the closet for the duration of the Cold War. And but now they can, now it's all, they can come back to maybe like sort of contextualize some of the stuff. Some of the paleocons are coming out of, are basically neo-Confederates. They're people like Melvin Bradford and Samuel T. Francis, who, if you read their writing, you know, like have very, have the old Confederate view of American history and opposition and, you know, including a very rosy view of sort of Jim Crow America. But also like sort of Catholic reactionaries like Buchanan and Joseph Soborn, who, you know, come out of a tradition and always saw democracy as being a threat to Christian value. And interestingly enough, there's a kind of reconciliation with a type of libertarianism that was never happy with the Cold War because it led to a big military buildup. The figure here is Murray Rothbard, who also becomes a very close to Buchanan and this sort of movement. So this is a very sort of motley crew, in some ways, you know, as diverse as fusionism, but they can come together under a new dispensation, not of anti-communism, but of anti-liberalism.
Right. And it becomes especially important that you have groups in there like Rothbard and this kind of anti-interventionist libertarianism, because that is going to give Buchanan real cachet in the 1990s and the 2000s. His opposition to the initial Persian Gulf War in the early 1990s, his critiques of major alienating international institutions, his opposition to, say, the WTO, and then his opposition to the war in Iraq in 2002 and 2003, which made him very much an outlier on the right, and for a while will get him read out of the conservative movement, but keeps him alive as a figure of relevance. There's a reason why MSNBC hires him in 2002, and it's because he is this conservative who's criticizing George W. Bush, and oh, isn't that interesting? And it allows him to be a pretty mainstream figure, even at a time that he is writing some pretty vicious stuff about immigration, about race, and still about anti-Semitism as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is very interesting. I mean, like, I'm old enough to actually remember the 1990s, and it's very distressing for me personally, as someone who was like very skeptical of globalism, that the only figures that you would see, you know, critical of NAFTA on mainstream television were Pat Buchanan and Ross Perot. And, you know, like, even though, like, I knew that there were a lot of people in, you know, who had very different politics, who were like in the labor movement, who were, you know, equally critical. So it is a sense in which, well, there's a couple of things you hit on there, and maybe that he was able to be the his relevance came from the fact that he could vocalize opposition to stuff that existed in the general country, but not in the establishment. And I would also say that a lot of his opposition transcended the normal right to left stuff. I mean, there would be a lot of people on the left who would have shared his critique of, you know, interventionist foreign policy and of these so-called free trade agreements, or and of globalization as it was being formed. But the other aspect that made him relevant, and it's again this kind of very inside outside thing that he always has, is this media approval he had. That even though this is someone who in his autobiography says Father Coughlin, we love that guy, and who under Reagan was defending the in a very vicious way the laying of a wreath at the Pittsburgh cemetery, mm-hmm. where SS members of the SS had been buried in Germany, and who then later, becomes the chief, the most vocal kind of defender of people accused of Holocaust crimes in the American media. All these things one would think would have made him a taboo figure, but he's always had a kind of, charmed circle of people in the media, including liberals, who love him. I mean, I actually very specifically remember Michael Kinsley, his co-host on Crossfire, defending him very. So what does that say? Like this sort of, cozy media culture that like sort of cuddled Buchanan.
It's such an important part of the story, because Buchanan is often presented as this outsider, as this almost a kind of populist who is rising up against the establishment. He was very much part of many establishments in the United States. Not only had he been working in the rarefied air of the White House, but in addition to his columns, he had been, from the start, the host of Crossfire when it launched on CNN in 1982, a regular part of the McLaughlin Group on PBS in 82 as well. And so he had become this figure in media, a household name, because millions of people saw him every week on television, in addition to reading his writing that was syndicated across the country. And behind closed doors, he was seen as somebody who was so charming, and had so many great stories to tell, and was so lively. And so he builds this real network of professional connections and friendships that keep him afloat for a very long time. And it is something that actually comes up in the 1992 campaign, because David Broder at the Washington Post is looking around and being like, y'all are being so nice because, it's Pat Buchanan. Yes, he might say some incendiary things, but we've seen him say incendiary things on television, and then we've chuckled with him in the green room afterwards. We know that he's not a real threat because he's somebody who we would invite over for cocktails. So how could he possibly be this awful fascist figure in American politics? And Broder is like, he is running for the president of the United States. You have to take him seriously and set aside some of those affections that you have for him. And what he was sensing was that there was a real softness in the coverage of Buchanan in 92, even though he was this very incendiary figure, often hateful figure, and very pivotal figure in U.S. politics, because he wasn't seen as a danger because he was seen as a friend. He wasn't seen as a kook because he was seen as a colleague. And that created a very soft space for Buchanan to land again and again while he was developing a pretty serious and pretty aggressive kind of politics.
Yeah, no, it is so interesting, like that sort of inside outside game, and also that if you're a media figure, you're allowed to get away with a lot more. As mm-hmm. The former president famously said, if you're a star, they let you get away with it. Which is that there's a sense in which, and this is actually a very big theme in your book, Partisans, which is part of what we're also seeing is the sort of fusion of media with and entertainment with politics. And there's a way in which in some ways being that TV star, being the guy on Crossfire who's arguing first with Tom Brady and then with Michael Kinsley, and then he's very fierce and aggressive then, but afterwards they're laughing, so that gives him like a kind of insulation and protection, because that's how they people in the media read him, like, oh, he's the guy who plays the right-wing fascist on Crossfire, but he's not really like that.
Yeah, this is the moment when you have such space for new varied forms of entertainment with the opening up of the AM radio dial, with the rise of cable television, that suddenly there's space for experimentation in political entertainment, and you get a lot of it. And what people find, what Pat Buchanan finds, what Rush Limbaugh finds, what Bill Maher finds, is that humor makes the pretty far right politics go down a lot easier. If you can put forward a very provocative idea and then get people to laugh, you have let that idea into the door. And now it is part of the conversation, or it lands much more softly than it would otherwise. And the kind of conservative punditry and media personalities coming out at this period, Buchanan is one, Limbaugh is one, Laura Ingraham, are people who are learning how to treat outrage as a kind of entertainment, while at the same time using the ability to blend outrage and politics to kind of move the Overton window, or to put into play ideas that would have been unthinkable if they hadn't come wrapped in a joke and laughs from a studio audience.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I mean, we don't usually think of Buchanan as a comedian in the Bill Maher, Laura Ingraham sort of sense, although, but he is kind of, he has a sardonic humor, which is very funny. The one example I'll cite is that when he was running for president, he had said, you know, well, this, what slogan are we going to use? There's the old one, you know, why not the best? But I think we're going to go with, why not the beast? It's a pretty funny joke.
Well, and it's really important because I think, you know, the 1992 convention speak looms so large in what people know and understand about Buchanan. And that's a pretty fierce speech. That's a pretty negative speech. And I think that it misses a lot of, first of all, that Buchanan got some laughs for that speech in the convention, but also how important that kind of humor and a kind of lightness of touch or irony that he used in his writings as well, how important that was to the politics that he was selling.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a sort of a crucial aspect. Now, it is true that, like, you know, Buchanan, the 92 election, he lost, but he did get that convention speech, and he forced, I think, the Bush administration to take, like, much more hardline stances. And I think, more broadly, I think it's important for listeners to understand that, like, a losing candidate still has influence because they show that there's a constituency and they reorient sort of politics. And what's striking, maybe, like, looking back on, you know, Buchanan in the 1990s, is that the issues that he hit on, you know, and which he challenged the Republican consensus on. So I would name sort of immigration, you know, being much more restrictive towards immigration, trade being more of a protectionist, international relations being much more, wanting more unilateralist, isolationist America rather than one that has many international commitments. And maybe the sort of fourth element is a sort of the story of America that he's telling, which is not the Reagan optimistic, you know, city on a hill, but rather, you know, like, we're in a deep crisis, we're in trouble. And some of that, I mean, comes from the old Catholic, you know, dark authoritarian view, but some of it actually came from Buchanan being a candidate and going out to places like New Hampshire and seeing, you know, that a lot of America, rural America, is being hollowed out. And it actually, I mean, if you look at his history, like, he actually changes his rhetoric and thinking about economic matters and realizing that the positive Reagan message is no longer resonant, that there's, like, you know, what's interesting is he lost on those. But if you look at where the Republican Party is in 2023, like he won, right? Like, he, the you know, like, a darker view of America and its mission and its, you know, prospects, nativism, protectionism, a more unilateral foreign policy, that's all kind of the package deal.
He was responding to very real conditions. The decline of the American working class was a big part of this, and he was addressing it there in New Hampshire. And he was picking up issues like NAFTA, that, as you mentioned earlier, Perot does as well, at the very moment that the Democratic Party is abandoning it. The fact that NAFTA was a bipartisan bill that was crafted by Republicans and signed into law by a Democrat, that was a big strain within the Democratic coalition that Clinton was going to sign NAFTA. And it suggested that there was a real distance between the elite and the establishment of the parties, and people who felt they weren't being heard. And the way that Buchanan responds to that, as he says, oh, what the unheard need is both protectionism, but they also need to believe that immigrants are the cause of all crime and bad things that happen in the United States, that they're the source of all the drugs, that all of your problems are actually the responsibility of immigrants. And yet he's speaking into a political vacuum of sorts, just as Perot was. And one of the fascinating things about the early 90s is, you know, we think about this as a decade of polarization and partisanship, but it's actually a decade where all of those lines are really scrambled in a lot of ways. The fact that Perot polls so well in the 92 campaign suggests that there are issues on the table that the Democratic and the Republican parties are missing. And I think that Pat Buchanan's, not only his success in raising those issues in 92 and moving the Republican Party, and of course the Democratic Party is going to move pretty close to his direction on immigration as well in just a few years, but Pat Buchanan does better in the 1996 campaign than he does in the 1992 campaign. The Republican Party is just much savvier about how they respond to him. They do not give him a primetime speech in 1996. They relegate him. They asked him for a tape and he refused and held his own like mini convention in response. But he was tapping into something that was real, and he was speaking to people who felt like they weren't being spoken for, and he was offering them up some solutions that the party is going to grab onto in really the 20-teens.
Yeah, no, that I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that is a major sort of theme in your book, and it's something I also, when I wrote about your book for The Nation, brought up, which is the sort of centrist consensus that started in the 1990s created space for Buchanan and many other figures to kind of take over. And it's a very important part of the story, but almost like rich enough for his separate podcast, which I hope we'll do. But I think that, you know, I think we've sort of covered this sort of ground of like why Buchanan is a kind of, you know, central figure. And I'll just maybe return to this point of like, you know, like William F. Buckley versus Buchanan that John Gans had brought up. I mean, I think one reason why Buckley gets so written about and is loomed so large in sort of popular memory or historical accounts is that he presented a conservatism that was palatable to liberals. That, you know, he's a guy that the editors of the New York Times could have dinner with and did often have dinner with and could occasionally invite into his their newspaper to write the occasional op-ed. And certainly when they were recruiting conservative columnists, they would try to go for more, you know, fusionist type figures like William Safire or David Brooks. That's a type of conservatism that liberals find acceptable. And therefore, you know, that's the type of conservatism that gets the long running show on public television and gets discussed in profiles. And that Buchanan's conservatism is less palatable, even though he also has his friends in the media. But I mean, like, it's something that's maybe a little bit more distressing, and therefore people are less willing to actually confront it and discuss it. So, which is why I think your book is like really important, like just like in, you know, in telling a truer history where Buchanan's real importance shines through. Did you want to like have any other thoughts on Buchanan's like legacy?
So I would just underscore, first of all, that how long-lived it was. Like, he was around and has been around for a very, very long time. He's in his 90s now. He's been incredibly influential. And I think that it's worth revisiting for folks who haven't spent a lot of time looking at, you know, whether it's him on CNN's Crossfire or on the McLaughlin Group, seeing him as a pundit and how he came to captivate so many Americans, but also maybe dig in a little bit to his writings, because it's there, I think, where you get the full Buchanan in his columns and in his books. He is perhaps even more incendiary there, but that's also where he's given kind of the intellectual space. If he was a popularizer in his columns and his television appearances, it's in those books that he really does lay out a framework for a new kind of conservatism at the turn of the 21st century, which is worth looking at because it's the conservatism that we have today.
Yes, I think that's a really good note to end on. So Nicole Hemmer, author of Partisans, I want to again thank you for being here. It was a very meaty and rich discussion.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.